Could you build a business that's better for our planet? That's what I have set out to answer. Hi, I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert and entrepreneur and host of the podcast, Someone Like You. I become fascinated in finding creative climate solutions in business, and on the podcast, I break down how founders and CEOs are building climate-friendly business solutions that are opportunities for growth while being better for the planet.
Take one step back and just consider the challenge. Two-thirds of the planet is water. It's an awful lot of space to try and monitor and understand what's happening out there. And human activity has expanded out on that area rapidly over the last few decades. We've seen a rapid advances in the amount of shipping, oil and gas exploration. We can get deeper and deeper into the water, whether it be these challenges around seabed mining. And of course, we're also building wind farms and aquaculture. So it really comes down to the fact that if you can't see this, you can't manage it.
A third of the world's fishing stocks are overfished, with the remaining two-thirds pretty much at capacity. Today's guest is ocean conservation expert and the 2023 TED Audacious Project grantee, Tony Long, CEO of Global Fishing Watch, an international nonprofit organization sharing open source information to combat illegal fishing practices. Tony spent 27 years with the British Royal Navy, and his love of the high seas led him to join the nonprofit sector. I speak with Tony on the problems of commercial fishing we face today, the various tools Global Fishing Watch uses to track fishing activity globally, and why making the data that we collect accessible to everyone is key. By continuing to break down electronic barriers and making fish data open source, Global Fishing Watch is paving the way to protecting our oceans by 2030 with transparent and accessible practices. I wanted to take a second to tell you about our Season 2 sponsor, Digital Scope. Did you know your website has a carbon footprint? Well, digital technology has a larger carbon footprint than the entire aviation industry, and it's only getting bigger. Digital power consumption is increasing by 9% every year. At this rate, our digital carbon footprint could be responsible for as much as 14% of global emissions by 2040. If you're a digital-first company, or really any company with a website, and want to understand the impact your website is having on the environment, Digital Scope can translate visitor data into carbon measurement, all with a simple one line of code added to your website. Check out digitalscope.com/someone like you. The first 100 people to sign up get free access for an entire year. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hello, pleased to be here.
I'm very excited to chat with you. I'm a fly fisherman. I've fished my entire life. I live on the west coast of Canada, so fishing and commercial fishing is very near and dear to my heart. But I have also, you know, been, because of this involvement, I've read a lot when it comes to overfishing and commercial fishing, and we're going to get into all these details. And there was an incredible book that I read years ago, also I believe out of the UK, called The End of the Line. And and I think they also did a documentary after as well, kind of one of the earlier kind of well-written books on, like, this is a huge problem, here's what's happening in this ocean that is so big. But before we kind of get into the industry side of things, what I'd love to understand is your background and how there, and if there's, where's that kind of potential connection to, you know, being involved in a such a strong sustainability initiative that you have with Global Fishing Watch.
Like you, linked very heavily to the water. I joined the Navy. I joined the Navy at the age of 17. And I've been linked to the ocean ever since in that way. So I must admit, when I joined the Navy, I didn't really know what I was joining. I knew I was going to go to sea. I had no idea just how it would affect me. And I wanted in leaving the military to make sure I was still connected with the ocean, still connected to the planet and the sustainability. And there was an opportunity to come into the not-for-profit sector. And I sort of jumped at it because what I learned in the Navy about how the ocean operates, how powerful it can be some days, how calm it can be the others, the biodiversity that you see, I wanted to do something to protect it. And by the time I came to the end of my career in the Navy, it was quite clear there were some areas that really needed a focus and additional help. And that's what really gave me that sort of decision to leave the Navy and join that the NGO sector and start to work on conservation.
And what was the first kind of conservation effort that you started?
So in my final couple of years in the Navy, I was working at the Naval Staff. This is right up at the top of the Ministry of Defence, working for the person that leads the Navy. And part of our role there was to investigate challenges for the future and understand how other people were dealing with the future. And a group called Environmental Justice Foundation gave a presentation on the challenges of illegal fishing around Sierra Leone and what they were doing to expose this bad practice. And they were quite literally going out on boats and taking a picture, a selfie for want of a better phrase, with a GPS location beacon in their hands. So, you know, you could read the latitude and longitude, the illegal fisher in the background with their name and their flag, and the fact that it was being taken from an artisanal fisher to prove that these vessels were inside of Sierra Leone's waters. And I thought, we can do that better. And my first opportunity to do that was to join the Pew Charitable Trust. And I left the Navy straight into Pew Charitable Trust to direct their campaign to end illegal fishing, where we were working on precisely these challenges about getting the right tools to the right people, to get regulations adjusted and implemented, and to build the structures needed in order to share information around the world and really give people that information so they could work together to combat illegal fishing. So that was the first step. I was there for 5 years and I loved every minute of it.
And when we think about, and we can get into this conversation of the illegal fishing aspect and how big it is and what the industry is and what you're trying to do. And, you know, we'll say that you're part of this TED infrastructure. You've just gotten some amazing amount of funding. I think it's close to $60 million through this audacious project. And what you're doing is the kind of unfathomable to think about how big of a problem it is across all the oceans and all the boats and all the commercial fishing. So we're going to chat about that, but What is the problem with commercial fishing today, and like, why were you investing so much of your time and interest into helping it? Like, where are the biggest faults of the commercial fishing industry right now?
Well, so if you just to take one step back and just consider the challenge, you know, 2/3 of the planet is water. It's an awful lot of space to try and monitor and understand what's happening out there, and human activity has expanded out on that area rapidly over the last few decades. We've seen a rapid advances in the amount of shipping, oil and gas exploration. We can get deeper and deeper into the water, whether it be these challenges around seabed mining. And of course, we're also building wind farms and aquaculture. So it really comes down to the fact that if you can't see this, you can't manage it. And that is really where the challenge starts. And fishing, being the biggest human activity out at sea, has been one area that people have been focused on now for several decades. The industrialization of the fishing fleet means they can fish further away from port, in deeper waters, in harsher conditions, for longer. And it's all connected by a global system of the economy, in the sense of the fishing vessels keep fishing, and then vessels will arrive, meet those fishing vessels, take the fish from them and bring them back to port. So there's not even a pause while the fishing vessels come back to port when you're looking at these industrial levels. And because of that huge increase in the amount of people fishing and the amount of fishing being done, and we've seen the actual fish stocks starting to decline. So 1/3 of the world's fish stocks are now overfished. And of the remaining 2/3, the majority of them are fished to absolute capacity. And where there's some, there is definitely some improvements in certain fisheries. We're not seeing a significant trend to bring that back into limits. So these are the challenges you've got to do. And somehow we have to bring all of the ocean communities together, whether it be countries responsible for these vessels or the management organizations, and get them acting as one to bear down on this pressure that's being put on the fish stocks.
And a lot of the commercial efforts to enforce some of the rules and guidelines, has it been largely, you know, fishing vessels have to just report their own catches? Is it, I know a lot of times individuals will be from government, individuals will have to go on boats to watch and see how much fish they're catching, any bycatch and that type of thing. What are some of the tools that that is pretty common being used right now to deal with this effort?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, because the technology that's given the fishermen the ability to fish further and deeper and harder, etc., same advances in technology mean that there should be better ways of monitoring and controlling the same fisheries. So some of the areas that most people would be able to quickly comprehend is, in the olden days, the catch would be recorded pretty much in pencil in a paper log. And that was very easy for any unscrupulous operators to doctor or mess around with, to put the incorrect figures in for their catch, to either launder catch or make sure any illegal catch still gets through the system. But people are moving now towards electronic catch documentation. So this is a digitized form of that log that at the end of each day is effectively closed and digitally signed, and it cannot be tampered with. So it's a very straightforward way of doing this. But of course, not every vessel has the electronic catch documentation. You've also seen a lot of advances in what is called electronic monitoring. Now, that would make you think you're sort of watching something from above, but actually the electronic monitoring is talking about the video monitoring of vessels. So there'll be cameras on a vessel looking at the catch deck, and you can see what is being brought on board, whether it be bycatch or protected species or the targeted species. So using these cameras, we can have a better understanding of what's happening out at sea. But you can imagine immediately the challenges of that, because there's a huge amount of data and a huge amount of vessels to try and pick through that sort of data. But it really is helping reduce bycatch. And then you come back to the systems like Global Fishing Watch. You know, when I moved to Global Fishing Watch, the aim was to shine a light on fishing activity around the world, because there was no combined information set of all of the fishing activity. And overnight, we started to show where 70,000 vessels were. Some 70,000 vessels that had never been tracked together before. And suddenly people had the information to start to understand where fishing patterns were happening, where the hotspots might be or might be developing. And it's where the idea of transparency driving the sustainability of our ocean was born from, and really where the Audacious project was born from as well.
And how did the initial early idea, you just kind of touched on it, how you got these 70,000 vessels, but how did that first idea of Global Fishing Watch kind of come together, and the individuals or organizations to put that together, how did that come to be?
Well, there were several non-government organizations looking at this problem. And one group called SkyTruth, a smallish technology NGO that were actually looking at oil spills on the ocean, had really good skills of monitoring the ocean to find out where oil slicks were and spills were happening. They got together with Google and said, hey, I think we can make a public map of all fishing activity, because we need to end this illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing problem that's causing so many problems. So they started to play with their code, play with artificial intelligence. It's really the advances in artificial intelligence has allowed us to advance so quickly in this global scale. And they produced the very basic map that Oceana, one of the, I think, the largest ocean-focused NGO, saw the opportunity here. So they were the three founding partners to this idea of shining the light on the fishing fleet, and they named it Global Fishing Watch. And at that stage, they needed a way of getting it out to the world, and that's when they brought me in as a CEO.
And the technology, I'm just assuming, you know, you're using AI. Obviously, you have some big technology partners which have, you know, incredible opportunities to build out mapping and mapping infrastructure. Is it all using, I'm assuming it's satellites that is grabbing all this data, and then AI is able to compute this into what we can kind of see so visually as a, you know, really a all these little dots and boats all over the whole ocean? Like how does the technology work?
It is initially, we've based it very heavily on satellite-based technology, because just the size of the problem, you need to be able to for our solution, you need to look at that global scale. So with the satellites now providing more data than ever, we want to utilize this. So there was a system called Automatic Information System, AIS. It was actually born out of the need to allow vessels to see each other in heavy weather or heavy seas and avoid collision. So it might seem remarkable to some, but everybody can see these super tankers. But if you're a small fisherman or a yachtsman, sometimes these bigger ships can't see you as you disappear behind the waves or in fog. So they have an electronic signal that they share on each other's radar systems that means they can avoid each other for collision. And this used to be a very coastal-based system, and you couldn't really see much beyond a few tens of miles from shore. But when they linked it to satellite, suddenly every vessel that was transmitting on this AIS system, you could see. So there was, I think, every vessel at the time we started, probably around 250,000 vessels transmitting this AIS. And what we taught through artificial intelligence and machine learning was the system to recognize different patterns of fishing operations. So whether it be a trawler that's drawing great big long lines in the ocean, in the sense of along contour lines where the fish are, or a posane, which operates in circles to close a net around the catch, or these long liners that literally lay out 30 or 40 miles of lines with hundreds of thousands of hooks on, you can spot that. You can see that and extract that information from those other many tens of thousands of vessels. And that was that initial global footprint of fishing we could see that sort of showed the 70,000 vessels. So the satellites give you the global range and that ability to work at that scale. But of course, with any system, there's pros and cons to it. So we don't see everything from those satellites. And I could tell you a little bit more about some of the other systems you use in order to close those gaps, if you like.
Yeah, because that's, when we think about overfishing, we think about massive tankers. And I think that there's like some of the trawlers, there's a lot of knowledge out there that some of them, are the size of like, they could fit like 747s. Like they're just absolutely massive. They drag along the ocean floor. They do immense amount of damage. But there's also, small fishing fleets with small boats, but there's sometimes hundreds and hundreds of them, which, in sensitive areas too, could be quite impactful as well. And often the smaller boats too could be, maybe they don't have as much of the regulation side. So can that technology find the smaller groups of little smaller boats that might not have the sophisticated technology like, radar on their boats?
The short answer is yes, but with some caveats. So what we're trying to do with Global Fishing Watch is make sure this information is available globally. We also want to make it available for free. To make it available for free, we have to consider the different systems that we're using in order that the cost of running this platform don't become too much for the philanthropies that support us, because we're a philanthropy driven organization. We need that support. So what we're using at the minute is we use AIS, which is very easy to detect, but not every vessel has it, and it can be turned off and manipulated. And the first thing we did was to really make sure we understood that AIS. So we've got experts now that are advising agencies around the world on how AIS can be manipulated. And actually, just imagine this, if someone turns off their AIS, it's the first big indicator that something's going to happen. So we're using that information to make sure we point our interest in those areas where vessels are turning off their AIS, indicating they may be about to do something unscrupulous. And where vessels try and trick you by like reversing their latitude and longitude, i.e. making them appear somewhere else on the ocean so it's difficult for you to find them, we can also spot that sort of manipulation. It's called spoofing. And the latest thing is to literally simulate tracks. And we can see that as well. Not that there's many fishermen simulating tracks. That's been used in for different reasons. But that was the first thing, is to become experts on these areas where the easiest way of tracking the vessels we can use to the maximum extent. And then we wanted to add in layers of data. So the first thing we did from that was to try and get to the country's proprietary data that's been traditionally proprietary under a system called the vessel monitoring system. And this is actually where all the phishing data sits. And it's really important to have access to that data because it tells you about the authorizations, when they say they've started phishing and when they've stopped phishing and things like this. And for a long while, people would not share that information easily. We've now got 12 countries committed to share that data and a queue of others now interested in doing so. And that's a significant shift, because that is fitted to all of the fishing vessels that the countries are authorizing in the majority of cases. So it's a big step forward. So that's the easiest way to track a vessel is have them tell you where they are. So when you start to look at these smaller vessels, which are much more difficult to detect by radar or by optical imagery or by any of the other systems, you really want to find a way that they will just share their position with you, because that's by far the most cost-effective way of doing it. And what we're seeing is these trackers are getting less expensive and they're getting smaller, and therefore it's much easier to fit it to the smaller vessels. And also the smaller vessels are being forced further out to sea all of the time because of the industrial fleet effectively hoovering up their resources. So they're also very interested in their own safety, and they want to be tracked in some cases to make sure people know where they are should they get into difficulty. So that's the first step in where we go. So that's that bit. And then if you like, I can talk a little bit more about then how you find the ones that aren't sharing their position.
Yeah, I think that's quite interesting. And from listening to the TED Talk as well, that was a pretty interesting and enlightening way how you're being able to do that.
Well, so this is key. So if we assume someone's going to do something bad, they're probably going to hide the fact. So they're going to turn those trackers off. So we need to use different sources of data. The ones that people tend to turn with, anyone who's doing this sort of monitoring will look at what we call synthetic aperture radar, which is space-based radar looking down on the ocean. It works very well through the day and the night and through cloud, and you know that something is present on the surface of the ocean. And that gives you a really good idea of presence. You can also supplement that with things like optical imagery, which is effectively a photograph from space. But these are quite difficult to use because you've got to point them very accurately at where you want to look. And it can be affected by the sunlight. It's obviously affected by cloud if there's cloud cover in the way. So you've got to know when and how to use optical imagery. And we use that to great effect when we were working in those North Korean waters. And then there's emerging technologies. One in particular is using the visual spectrum. So you'll see lights on the surface of the ocean, and we can extract those lights, remove the static installations, and then you're looking at vessels that have got really bright lights. And actually, strangely, some fishing vessels use really bright lights to bring their catch to the surface, mainly squid and a species called saury. And if you can detect those lights, you know that they're there. So you're starting to layer up these informations that these things are happening. And then finally, just one area that's really emerging quite quickly is what we call radio frequency, which is the detection of electronic emissions from the vessel. And you can geolocate the vessels by detecting those emissions and doing a little bit of trigonometry effectively. So all of these things layered together, you start to get a good understanding of where that hidden, that dark fleet, as we sometimes refer to them, is around the world.
So you have three large technology companies coming together, building this kind of global platform. You know, you have obviously years of experience in the Navy and in the nonprofit sector working on illegal fishing. You build this technology, you want it to be free. My mind kind of goes to kind of two things. Like, how do you keep this thing funded as a nonprofit? And we could talk about the Audacious project. And then the other one is, how do you get people to use it? And who are the people to use it? Because obviously these tools are incredibly valuable if they're available. And then once they're available, people need to use it. So, you know, maybe starting with how do you get people to use it, and then the funding side.
Well, this is a key part of why our founding organizations set up Global Fishing Watch as they did. They wanted it to be global in reach and available to all and free to access. And it was that free to access point which was key, because the reality is access to technology tends to be expensive and it tends to be highly competitive. So if you imagine two private companies selling their data to two adjacent countries, it's very difficult for those countries to share that data when the competition is there. They want to own the data rather than share the data. So we need to break that down to a degree. And that's what the transparency side of Global Fishing Watch does. By making the data freely available to all, you break down those electronic barriers that are formed in competition or because people believe that the proprietary data is more useful to them, when the reality is it's far more useful out in the open. So that's where we've started to see the interest in Global Fishing Watch. The other piece is, the number of communities that can use our data is huge. That first map of the 70,000 vessels, researchers clambered to use that immediately because all of a sudden, overnight, they had the data they needed to do their research without waiting months, potentially years, to get the data from different countries at different times. So you will have seen, I've lost count of the number of peer-reviewed papers now published based on our data that have helped drive an understanding of what's happened out on our oceans. There was a very good paper went to the World Trade Organization that explained that around 50% of all of the activity happening on the high seas was only economical because of the link to bonded labor and harmful subsidies. And that wasn't possible before our data was there. These sort of bits of information are really good. So the research community have clambered for it, and they're probably our biggest users. And then governments realized that there was a lot of complementary information within Global Fishing Watch that would allow them to use their own systems differently. So we've seen governments start to use the system now to back up their own systems that tend to be very good and live. The live data is really good, but the historical data is really difficult to get at. And Global Fishing Watch's historical information is really easy to get at. And it's actually very important to understand the patterns of fishing in order that you understand where your patrols might need to be or where your hotspots are. So you're starting to see people realize that this open data is highly valuable. The US Coast Guard realized that really quickly. We did patrols of them out in the North Pacific. And in the first patrol, along with a few other improvements in their patrol planning, we got an 800% increase in the efficiency of their boardings and the finding of violations. Again, just by looking at the patterns of operations and making sure that we were putting the vessels in the right place. So you'd be surprised at the number of people that are using our data for this reason. More recently, we've seen industry far more interested in providing some kind of due diligence on the supply chain. And can this transparency methodology mean that they can look more closely at that supply chain to understand where the fish is coming from and that it hasn't been caught illegally or have any other nefarious activities formed? And we're starting to see now interest from fisheries partnerships and agencies that are looking at the industrial side of things, including insurers and bankers. So just the availability of the data, that's the game changer. The fact that it's open and it's not restricted by our ability to share it, it's only restricted by the number of people that can get access to it and use it, and that's open. So we expect to see big things after the Open Ocean Project and Audacious.
Yeah, and that I'm assuming because it's a big open global platform with data that's available for, like you said, everyone from government officials to fishing companies, industry to researchers, you decided to apply to TED's internal Audacious project. And, I'd love to just understand how that came to be and what that means for Global Fishing Watch in terms of funding and opportunities and being able to kind of scale this platform across the world.
Yeah, the Audacious project was fantastic news. And just to be clear, we didn't apply. Someone nominated us for it. And when we got the call, I had to sort of clear my head and understand what they were offering here, because this is a huge opportunity to be put in front of so many donors and to be able to place such a clear vision, such an audacious vision down on the table and have it funded like so readily was a challenge in itself. There's a lot of work had to go in to make sure that we put this proposal together appropriately. But it was a significant moment. I think there was more than 1,000 organizations considered, and they filtered it down to around 90. And from that 90, they then worked hard to work out who the finalists were. And our cohort of 10 in 2023, it was an amazing set. to be able to do that. So the Audacious project has mean we can accelerate our vision really rapidly. I've always wanted to map more information, but as we were extracting information from the map in order to present the fishing data so clearly, we knew that this other data was valuable, but we didn't have the resource to put it back into the map in a way that it would be useful to other people. So the Audacious project is allowing us to do that. We're going to put back in very clearly where the oil and gas infrastructures are. And we're going to work with people like SkyTruth in order that they can map and monitor oil and gas and its expansion and changes, and work with other partners to hold governments to account to the way that they're driving the oil and gas industry. We can use it to monitor shipping, all shipping, which means we're not just monitoring the fishing, but we can consider noise pollution from shipping and how that affects marine protected areas or biodiversity. And we can also look at oil spills and bad behavior in that sense. And as I've mentioned before, even wind farms, they need to be put in the right place. Renewable energy is really important, but put in the wrong place can have a negative effect. So we'll work with agencies that are looking at the renewables and how we're using the ocean to put wind farms in place and make sure that we help them put them in the right places. So that's what Audacious is doing, is just putting a whole new set of data out there for other people to use. And it's just when it's needed most because of the challenges to the way the planet is responding to the climate change.
Yeah, and with the Audacious project, you get funding, I believe it's $60 million over a five-year period. So I'm assuming that's allowing you to hire people, allowing you to, you know, get partnerships and bring those in. And you mentioned it allows you to also work towards realizing your vision. And so if we think about the next kind of 3 to 5 years, what does that vision look like?
Yeah, so the money is helpful in many ways. You know, obviously we're busy building this map. It allows us to retain people as well. That's important because they've learned a lot, and we want to make sure we retain that expertise, as well as hire to allow us to attain these higher levels. This is important. The money actually isn't all for Global Fishing Watch. Some of it will go to subcontractor partners to make sure that we bring in the expertise where it is, and that we're not just trying to create the expertise ourselves. So those subgrants and partners are really important to the delivery of this project. And then the other bit that people tend to forget is there is an element here that the data can be there, but somebody has to do something with the data. So part of what we do at Global Fishing Watch is work with governments, work with other NGOs, work with industry in order that they can leverage our data to do something good. So there's a policy program implementation element to what we want to do. And just some of the money out of Audacious will help us found that work, but we will be seeking further support to be able to accelerate and amplify that program work in able to help deliver the bigger program piece. So enforcement, capacity building, all of these things will need additional partnerships. And what I'm hoping is people realize that with this data so robustly provided, that this is the opportunity to really get the data to people in order that they can push for the changes, whether it be to drive 30 by 30, this need to protect 30% of the ocean by 2030, or to understand what's happening out on the high seas as we negotiate and implement the High Seas Treaty.
Yeah, and this is obviously the timing is needed now. We are expected to get to a global population that is nearing 10 billion people, and seafood is an important part for, you know, billions of people in terms of their diet. And I think we can't keep doing what we're doing to our oceans in the way that we're taking. And so, you know, a lot of the branding of this and this podcast is a bit initiated by the book The Lorax by Dr. Seuss, which, you know, is really very similar in sense to fishing and commercial fishing, where you just kind of keep using these resources that you think are going to be endless and all the repercussions from it. And one of the things that a lot, and I think about your story and what's so incredible about it is, you know, the work that you're doing and the team and everybody that came together to build this thing is, it's just a huge, huge problem. And like you said, two-thirds of our earth is the ocean. And so what do you tell people that are, you know, or what would you say to somebody that is, you know, thinking about and being involved in something that is a climate initiative or a sustainability effort or starting a nonprofit or starting, you know, a for-profit venture, but just trying to, you know, work in this, you know, work within this space?
Well, I would encourage them to do it. But I would obviously encourage them to do their research. There's a lot of people with a lot of ideas out there. Some of them are very similar. And where there is a benefit to competition to drive the very best solutions, at some stage there needs to be some collaboration as well. So understanding the problem that you're trying to solve and who else is trying to solve it and trying to make something that's scalable to the problem you're trying to solve. And there's a lot of agencies out there helping you. So I am a mentor at the Sustainable Ocean Alliance. And this is an amazing organization that brings young entrepreneurs together and gives them advice from, I think they've got more than like 100 mentors that have done this sort of thing before, gives them the advice and support they need in order that they can build their idea. And they get to pitch it. They also get to connect up to other entrepreneurs and funders. And there's been many of those initiatives have seeded and move forward. So there's definitely a need for innovation. It's really where it's at. But I would like to take like a step back. And you know, we often think governments are the ones to make these decisions, whether it be putting plastic into the ocean, whether it be about choosing the seafood that you eat. Ultimately, we as individuals have got to make some choices as well. And they're not easy choices because things are put in front of you so easily that it's very, very easy to pick up the three peppers in the plastic bag rather than three loose peppers to go find the weigh machine. And somehow we've got to start to change some of the behavior that isn't immediately obvious that it's causing a problem, but ultimately it builds up to generate that waste that then can't be recycled properly or ends up in the ocean. So some personal responsibility from everybody, even a little bit, is going to help. And then any entrepreneur that's got an idea, really get the research, try and join a group that can help bring them together with other entrepreneurs, build the idea into something better, or join forces with somebody else.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us. How can listeners find out more about Global Fishing Watch and find you online?
So Global Fishing Watch has got a great website at www.globalfishingwatch.org. And we're now live on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram as well, easily findable through the website. There's some great stories on the website. It tells you the different impacts we've been having. Some of these impacts initially are quite small, but through Audacious, we're going to grow them into something far more tangible. And we encourage feedback as well. So within the website, you can actually give feedback to the way you've been using the platform in order that we can improve it for everybody.
Yeah, and look up Tony Long, Global Fishing Watch on TED, and you'll see his TED Talk, which was a really incredible TED Talk, and it is spreading like fire as well. And so hopefully people can learn a little bit more. And thank you so much for all the work that you've been doing, Tony, and all the dedication to like what is a massive issue and something that we need people like you and the team at Global Fishing Watch. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. I love my work and I'm really glad you gave me the opportunity to tell people about it.
Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and a review.